It's Tuesday, October 26, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Reports coming out from Washington and the Federal Election Commission indicate that next Tuesday's midterm election may be the most expensive of its kind in American history. Now, in one sense, that's hardly surprising. Given inflation and other economic shifts, just about every campaign season is more expensive than the one that preceded it. But in this case, there's a good deal of data that should capture our attention. For instance, it is estimated that the House and Senate races this year will surpass $2 billion in spending for the first time. Dan Egan, writing at the Washington Post, says, to put it another way, that's the equivalent of about $4 million for every congressional seat up for grabs this year. Now, time was, there were very few congressional districts that would have merited a $1 million total campaign expenditure. That's both sides put together. But in recent years, that landscape has changed, and the increasing costliness of political campaigns for House and Senate seats, well, that all adds up to a difference in the way our economy works, and more fundamentally, in the way that our democracy works. This particular story indicates that what we have been observing in terms of advertising and other campaign expenditures really is just about as pervasive as it has seemed. And speaking of the advertising, have you noticed how absolutely wretched much of this advertising is becoming? As it turns out, at this point, both sides in most campaigns believe that negative campaigning is what actually works. There is plenty of data to back them up, suggesting that voters are more motivated to vote against a candidate than for one in this particular kind of election cycle. Now, what we're looking at in these advertisements, in many ways, is an absolute act of disrespect to the American voter. Rather than dealing with issues, in a halfway reasonable format and way of presenting the issues of the day, what we have is the lowest common denominator of innuendo, outright slander, and misrepresentation. One of the things to watch in this particular campaign season is something that is becoming a staple in American political campaigns. A campaign will take a speech made by an opponent and take out a few words, a tiny little soundbite, perhaps even a soundbite of a soundbite, and present it as if it were a standalone comment, as if it were the point of the speech. Another thing, of course, that happens is that you will hear that this person or that person voted against this or that. But many of those particular votes took place in a larger legislative context where no one at the time would have characterized the vote in that way. Now, we are entering the silly season in American politics. When you get within the last week of a campaign of this magnitude, you can count on all kinds of things happening, most of them unpleasant, all of them calculated to do whatever it takes to get a candidate over the line. It's going to be a long week between now and next Tuesday. Speaking of the silly season, it seems appropriate to mark the fact that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, both comedians and entertainers, are going to be heading for their rally in Washington, D.C. Now, this has been contextualized in the media as a response to Glenn Beck and his massive movement On the Mall. But what's really interesting here is the fact that comedy is replacing a serious exchange of ideas. Now, I'm encouraged by the fact that some liberal commentators are disturbed by this. For instance, Gail Collins in the New York Times. What we observe when politics is reduced to a laugh line, as it is so often, and so often in such a clever context, and so humorously, as conducted by Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, what we see is the debasement of political discourse. Now, Colbert and Stewart are hardly the first to enter into this process, and, quite honestly, many politicians are adept at making themselves look foolish without the help of a comedian to point out their foolishness. But something is missing in our political discourse. Something is happening in this political season that ought to concern us all. What we have in a laugh line is very different than what we have in a reasoned political discourse. Those who have a difference of political opinion, and as we well know, there is a deep cleavage in the American electorate over so many issues, those who ought to argue the issues are not well served by someone who makes light of them. Now, interestingly, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert have both become, in their own way, very important parts of the liberal political infrastructure in America. It happens as Jon Stewart is becoming more and more openly politicized, and as Stephen Colbert is using his false conservative character to great political and comedic advantage. We'll be watching events closely in coming days. They'll tell us not only a good deal about this campaign, but about our nation's future. Here is something really interesting out of Japan. This comes from Sunday's edition of the Washington Post. The headline is this: Japan's young men seek new path. Well, what's this all about? Well, it has to do with what is often described as a metrosexual renaissance among Japanese males, especially young males, talking about young men here, and especially the ages 20 to 34. To read from the article by Chico Harlan, he writes, Japan's young men mystify their girlfriends and their bosses. They confound the advertisers who aim products at them. They've been scrutinized and categorized by social commentators, marketing consultants, and the government. And they unnerve just about everybody who makes long-term projections about Japan's flagging birth rate and fading economy. Japan will grow or falter, economists and sociologists say, upon the shoulders of these mild, frugal, sweet-mannered men. End quote. Now, Mr. Harlan points out that this particular cohort of the Japanese population, these young men between the ages of 20 to 34, they don't buy the kinds of things they did before, for instance, a car. Instead, they're more likely to spend money on cosmetics. No kidding. Back to the article, he writes this. To hear the analysts who study them tell it, Japanese men ages 20 to 34 are staging the most curious of rebellions, rejecting the 70-hour work weeks and purchase-for-status ethos that typified the 1980s economic boom. As the latest class of college graduates struggles to find jobs, a growing number of experts are detecting a problem even broader than unemployment. They see a generation of men who don't know what they want. End quote. Now, every civilization, note this, every single civilization has found one of its greatest challenges, the channeling of the energies of young males. This goes all the way back to the writings of Plato and Aristotle. It goes back even more proximately to the 19th century and the rise of the British system of turning boys into young men into productive citizens. In America, it's been much the same way. The entire movement of scouting emerged from this kind of concern, as did the so-called muscular Christianity of the YMCA and other movements in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The military was, of course, a chief means of moving young men into adult manhood, but what we now have in Japan, as well as in much of the rest of the world, is that something is broken with that system. And it's showing up in Japan in this most unusual of ways, with young men who would rather spend money on cosmetics than cars. The most interesting statement in this article is that this generation of Japanese young men seems not to know what it wants. But the most challenging and frightening thing about this article is that it appears that what they do not want is not only a job like their father or grandfather had, but a wife and children. That is far more devastating. The personal and social costs of that decision is far greater than any matter of mere economics. Another article out of Japan is also of interest. The Chicago Tribune is reporting that the Walkman is going to become a matter of history, at least the cassette version of Sony's iconic music player. It is now over 30 years old. It debuted in July of 1979, and since then, Sony has sold 220 million cassette Walkman. Now, I was frankly shocked that the thing was still being made. It's hard for me to imagine that for some time now there's been much of a market for a cassette Walkman. But it turns out that a good number of persons have cherished cassette tapes that they just didn't want to give up, and much of that music or programming has been, well, at least at this point, not digitalized so that it can be played on an iPod or similar music players. But the future, no, indeed even the present, is digital, and the cassette tape has very little place in the future. Now, here's an interesting point. This cassette Walkman is going to disappear as it is made in Japan and sold in Japan, Europe, and the United States. But it will still be made in China. Because in China, even where the digital revolution has indeed made tremendous progress, there is still a role for the cassette tape. Perhaps one of the great dividing lines in American and world history is the dividing line between the cassette tape and digital medium. Perhaps one of the great economic fault lines in the world today is between those who still would use a cassette tape and those, like so many young adults today in America, who frankly hardly even remember that they ever existed. Back in the United States, and looking at the election, a couple of interesting news accounts are pointing to the role of the homosexual vote in the midterm elections, and for President Barack Obama, some ominous signs looking to the year 2012. Tammy Weber, writing for the Associated Press, indicates that angry gay voters are disenfranchised or disaffected and very disappointed with President Barack Obama for his recent acts and for the lack of progress they see in any movement towards the legalization of same-sex marriage, the direct repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and various other things they felt were promised to them by Senator Barack Obama as a candidate and then by President Barack Obama. They and others are pointing to what they see as a lack of a connection to fulfillment and promise from those of the critical promises made during the campaign. Now, another interesting story appeared in the New York Times, and the headline really says it all. Gains are seen for transgender candidates. Jesse McKinley and Malia Wallen, writing for the New York Times, indicate that the year 2010, with these midterm elections, may be the year of the transgendered candidate. The one they profile is Teresa Sparks, a candidate for the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Now, as you look at this particular article, what becomes more and more interesting is the kind of language that is used to describe how a person of one gender becomes a candidate of a different gender and how voters try to figure all these things out. Well, the news story is interesting and rather self-explanatory, but the take-home value of all that is this. This is one of those news stories which we just have to admit would make virtually no sense whatsoever to an American who even as few as 10 years ago might have been reading the newspaper. The kind of language that is used in this article to describe what is called transitioning from one gender to another was a part of the language that simply had to be invented given the new sexual and relational chaos of postmodern America. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I hope you'll help me by helping me to understand how this resource can be made most helpful to you. In recent weeks, as we've begun this process, the program has grown in length just because there have been so many things to discuss. In an effort to maintain the concept of a short briefing that we hope will be helpful to you for the day, we're going to try to keep this at right at about 12 minutes. Please let us know if this is helpful. What was most helpful to you? Please let me know just by sending an email to mail@albertmohler.com. And in the meantime, thanks again for listening. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.